impulses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Precognitive
dissonance. All right, everybody.
Broadcasting live from the face on Mars, it's Precognitive Dissonance. And that's all we're going to do because you've already heard the intro. You know what you're listening to and why.
Well, thanks for tuning in to Anomaly Radio. I'm Smiles Lewis.
I'm Craig York.
And we are here to talk about more weird stuff, as usual.
This week in the weird news.
What has been in the weird news lately?
Well, it's kind of interesting. The UFO Mystic site, run by your friends Nick Redfern and Greg Bishop.
They don't run it. They just write for it.
Well, okay then. Supplied content by... that's awkward. It seems to me that a while ago, Greg Bishop wrote a piece, and there's a tone throughout a lot of the earlier posts, 3-4 months back, kind of decrying the current state of ufology. And it's kind of, you know, oddly refreshing this week to see, you know, something in the old fire. In a strongly worded refutation of a recent piece on the UFO iconoclast, which alleged that the Roswell crash...
Claptrap.
Claptrap. That the Roswell crash could be attributed to a Navy blimp.
Balloons.
A blimp is a little bit different from a balloon in that it's powered, for one thing.
And it has a more structured gondola.
And
engines.
A larger gondola, engines. Usually a crew of 2 to 4, I believe. Typically the Navy patrol blimps were crews of 2. Miles is chasing his cat. And by another UFO blog, The Other Side of Truth.
By Paul written, Kimball.
Paul Kimball.
RedStarFilms.blogspot.com.
Basically said, you guys don't know what you're talking about. Did a little bit of modest Googling. Came up with several images of said blimp. And I have to say, I saw the iconoclast piece a little earlier this week, and I was just like, well, I suppose it's possible. File under N for not likely. For one thing, you know, the blimps were predominantly naval weapons. They were stationed mainly on the East Coast. I think there were some West Coast blimps, although Japanese submarine, not something we were worrying too much about in the closing year of the war in the Eastern Pacific. But it's one of those, it kind of begs the question, why would a qualified Army Air Force officer misidentify a crashed blimp as a flying disc?
Well, I still go back to, you know, it seems highly possible and probable that the whole thing was a cover story from the beginning, that flying saucer was either well before then or after then deemed a great way to cover up anything that, you know, might happen in the way of experimental this, that, or the other, whether it was a blimp or a Fugo balloon with Japanese experimentees, the old weather balloon or the mogul.
Yeah.
I think it would suit the military better at that time for the Soviets to think that, could they really have extraterrestrials? Instead of, well, or was it just a balloon
Stalin
monitoring?
Siberia, where is my flying saucer? We'll get one right away.
And actually, do you remember the footage of that fat flying wing flying saucer that was shown probably about 10 years ago on TV for the first time? It's this. It looks like a pill flying at you.
Barely hovers above the ground, has a pair of cockpits off to either side.
Possibly.
Are we talking about the Avro car?
Oh, no. Russian.
Okay.
It looks like one of those elongated pills.
Yes, okay, the disco plan, I believe it's called.
Okay, I think that sounds right. And I think it can take off. It takes off and or lands. Or it takes off and lands on water, and so it was amphibious potentially. But I think it also could take off on a regular runway. I remember seeing pictures of it, like in UFO magazine, years and years before then, seeing video footage of it on TV, and I think I found it online at some point.
Let's do a quick Google for Discoplan.
Okay.
Because you've piqued my curiosity, because I've seen one image of it on, I believe it's Gilbert Niehaus.
Discoplan?
Diskoplan. A site that I have neglected to mention, the IFO library. Again, it's a Dutch gentleman, Gilbert Niehaus. We can look that up in a little bit, and I will, if I'm almost certainly wrong. But that's the only place I've seen reference to it. And
what's coming up at this image at airliners.net is... looks like a regular, something like that. But that's not what I'm talking about. No, this is large. This is like for a passenger aircraft.
The object I'm thinking of was actually rather small. And let me see if I'm understanding your description correctly. Kind of like the top half of a cold capsule. Turned sideways.
Right.
Okay.
That thing.
Lozenge.
A lozenge coming
okay,
straight
that,
at you. I've seen this thing flying. Right now I'm at stuffyoucanuse.com. Aviation Concern EKIP. UFO. That's right. I remember.
EKIP, yes.
The UFO. USA purchases Russian UFOs. Wondering about the UFO sightings. Maybe one of these.
And, yes, I have... this one had slipped my mind. It's an interesting, I believe, hybrid airship aircraft. It has substantial gas cells, also has airplane-style control surfaces.
Are you sure about the...
Well, no, evidently it doesn't have any gas cells. I must be high on life.
Well, I mean, I was curious that you would say that since we were talking about balloons and all, and dirigibles, and okay, it's something that occurred to me while you were talking about, we were both mentioning the UFO connection, mm-hmm. rather the inflatable balloon connection to UFOs, and of course, one of the modern interpretations of Black Triangle UFO sightings is that there's some kind of modern heavy lifting device for the military, lighter than mm-hmm. aircraft, that only looks like a hardcore structured craft as opposed to just some floating. And that's its seeming ability to radically change direction at high speed and come to a crawl and hover and all that, you know, would be very useful for a lot of purposes, but isn't what one usually thinks of when they think of balloon craft of any variety.
Yeah, the enormous flying triangles that were making the news periodically a few years ago, that some of the aviation press speculated were in fact either the term stealth blimp. And that second photograph there, in the second row, just below that close-in weapon system, that's the one that I saw.
Well, this is that same thing. This is on that other page.
Okay.
That's a shot of it in the warehouse.
And that's...
The page you were thinking of?
Yes.
The IFO picture library. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You were just talking about this. Yeah. At laceyworks.com. That's LaeSieWorks.com. LaeSieWorks.com. /IFO/lib. And that'll get you there. Wow, these are great.
There are some marvelous images on this site, and this is, come to find out, kind of a tribute to the human spirit, because the gentleman that created this site is now pretty much paralyzed from the neck down as a result of a motorcycle accident several years ago. If you go to the homepage, he's got a biography of himself, and just a remarkable individual.
Giesbert?
Giesbert.
This is, again, LaeSieWorks, L-A-E-S-I-E, works.com. Is it at the main? And... Gilbert, Giesbert, Niehus.
Giesbert.
There he is. Yeah, to learn about me. Born in 1969, has a spinal cord injury since 95. Nowadays, I can only move my head and am always in pain. Good. Before the car accident, I was a young photographer and illustrator and made music for fun. Nowadays, I do all kinds of serious and fun stuff on a head movement controlled computer using the Origin head mouse and keystrokes. It's just about as easy for me to use a computer as it is for a normal person. I made this entire website using head movement only. And it's a very nice looking website.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, yeah, LaeSieWorks.com/IFO, and that'll get you to the Identified Flying Objects archive here with great pictures of man-made UFOs.
Now, I discovered it years ago looking for, one, man-made UFOs, and two, sniffing on the track of the myth of the Nazi flying saucers. And he has a collection of photographs that he basically labels fakes. There are some things that are kind of making the rounds. And caution I will add to all our listeners is that Giesbert asks that you not link directly to his images. Apparently this is a bandwidth issue, and he gets socked hard, basically exceeding certain limits. So,
no hot linking.
Copy those images, friends. Or, yes, no hot linking.
Now, because you said that, somebody's going to be, oh, yes.
Well, then they should be ashamed of themselves. Also has a very nice page on the PyWacket project, which is an extremely obscure defense missile, one of the rare instances of the Air Force exploring bomber-sighted anti-aircraft missiles. These were...
lenticular-shaped body.
Mm-hmm. These were intended to defend the B-70 supersonic bomber, which was produced as two prototypes, and basically the Air Force went, well, there's nothing can fly high enough and fast enough to outrun the current crop of Soviet anti-aircraft missiles. Well, bummer.
Except UFOs and Foo Fighters.
Well, there is that.
Flying discs.
Interestingly enough, my friend Mark Finn, some years ago, turned me on to a book about a fellow named John Boyd, I believe Colonel John Boyd, who was essentially kind of the Maverick Dean of American fighter pilots from the Vietnam era through the 80s. He was kind of the originator of, if not the term, the concept of the fighter mafia in the U.S. Air Force, which is basically the folks who push fighters at pretty much the expense of just about everything else. He was a very vocal critic. Apparently, he was one of those fellows who was, you know, on the one hand, brilliant. He came up with a number of essentially formula for modern air combat using jets, and pretty much revolutionized jet air combat. He was essentially one of the fellows that brought back the concept of dogfighting.
With jets, yeah, awesome.
Well, this is probably a bit obscure to a lot of our listeners, but there was a period from about 1955 to almost 1965 where it was pretty much considered that the old sneak up behind them, get them in your sights, and press the trigger gave way to, you know, lock them on the radar 10 miles away and launch a missile. And it was fairly quick. And the Soviets never really quite abandoned the gun. They got close to it with a couple of aircraft. But for a period of about, I think, 7 years, really a hard 7 years, between 1955 and 1962, gun armament was pretty much on its way out for American fighter aircraft. It was all going to be done with missiles.
All video game style.
Well, and be fair, this was, you know, 15 years before video games really came into their own.
I flash on that Roger Waters lyric, you know, the bravery of being out of range.
There is, you know, let's just say I don't have quite the esteem for fighter pilots that I used to, or for, you know, Air Force in general. But, you know, that's a subject for another time. Where was I digressing from? Yes, John Boyd. In this book about this, you know, very important yet strangely obscure individual, there's a passage where the author cites an exchange between an unnamed aeronautical engineer who says, "Mr. Boyd, lenticular craft are the shape of the future." And, you know, in the future, you know, if a plane has a shape, it will be lenticular. And Boyd is supposed to have just basically said, "You're full of shit." you know, possibly quite literally. Apparently, he was a very coarse individual when, you know, the occasion prompted. But Pywacket is the only solid instance I know of a lens-shaped or disc-shaped craft being explored by the Air Force. Now, there have been recently, and there's even a model of the supposed medium-sized Air Force flying disc, which also shows up on this site. Interestingly enough, the photograph, which looks astonishing, is identical. More UFO than IFO. That top U.S.-built flying wing aircraft. If you'll click on the center photograph in the top row, and you see what looks like a large flying disc flanked by what appear to be an F-86 Sabre jet, which is an early swept-wing fighter, and I not sure if it's another F-86. The problem is that photograph is equal to another photograph which has an entirely different aircraft where the disc is. And when I say identical, it's identical even to the placement of the human figures in the photograph. Reading up on this, there is allusion to names that crop up in Nazi flying saucer mythology, specifically Mitha, who was supposed to be a German engineer who perfected a 1,300 mile an hour vertically rising disc shortly before the end of the war.
Yeah. This is saying on this page, U.S. built flying wing disc aircraft ?46-67, and there's a quote here saying that somebody named Mike created all of these because they weren't that they the Air Force refuses to declassify this.
The fellow who produced the kit of the saucer linked to a website. This is probably close to a year ago on Starship Modeler, where the story of these discs were told, and supposedly they were parked out in the open at a remote corner of a Florida Air Force base, and that a staff sergeant, that first the guy just basically drove by, saw these things, and his eyes bugged out, so he inquired at the base, and the staff sergeant took him out to take a look at the things and said, yeah, they've been here for 10-15 years. They're just basically rotting away. Nobody knows about them, and nobody's supposed to know about them, but, you know, what the hell.
Okay, so these pictures look real. These are really well-done fakes. The quote here is, Mike, all of these photos are computer-generated forensic composite illustrations. None of them are official USAF photos. Since the USAF seems very reluctant to declassify these birds, I created these illustrations to give people an idea of what they looked like. Yes, they really did exist, but due to some stability problems, this particular model was scrapped. Dated 8/29/2004. I mean, these photos are really...
Oh, they are. They are very sharp. They're a very curious blend of the just ultra streamlined, but at the cockpit placement, and it has a very tall vertical fin that's very anachronistic, at least in terms of the design. It's off of something like a B-29 bomber, just very tall, very thin, very slightly swept leading edge. The cockpit is tiny. These discs are probably, well, the one in the photograph that Miles is popping back and forth between is probably about, I'm going to guess, between 50 and 60 feet in diameter.
I didn't even realize there's two in this photo.
Oh, yes, the larger disc in the background, which is even larger.
And notice that it's in line with...
Mm-hmm.
Is this a B?
That's a B-29.
And it's fin. I mean, it's got the nook and the hanger for it. Y'all got to check this out. This is at lacyworks.com/ifo/lib/usdiscwing.html. Of course, you'll have to find the links through the main site because there are capitals that are probably required in that URL. But it's pretty darn cool.
It's a neat image, especially since you can flip back and forth between the two to compare how these things, you know. Whoa.
That's bad monitor.
Bad monitor. You're at bastard?
Bad monitor.
Can I say that on the air?
You can say whatever the effing you want.
Oh, okay. anyway.
Now, this one there looks a little more... Like the color looks a little off, but wow. Anyway,
well,
so is there
pull,
any
pull
proof?
That schematic up, if you would.
Is there any proof of this? I mean, has other than this person's word, have these ever been declassified?
No. As far as I know, there is no patent work to back these up. And that's another very entertaining site, the name of which escapes me, but I will try and remember it for next week. It's something lounge. But it's patent drawings of aviation patents, specifically aircraft patents. And there are some truly weird stuff in there. I think a book I've mentioned before, Man-Made UFOs, 1944 to 1994.
It's in the other room, yeah.
Has a number of patent drawings in it. And none of them are like this. The interesting thing about the design from the photographs is, A, there's no visible intakes. They're presumed to have been jet-powered, but it's kind of hard to see how. The sighting of the cockpit is just plain bad.
You're on top of this huge flying pan. How would you be able to see below you?
below you and the...
You just have a horizon view, basically.
Well, the one thing that I have learned is that the view from the cockpit is not terribly important once you've got the thing off the ground, but... Getting it off the ground in the first place, and especially getting it back on the ground, view from the cockpit is a very, very important thing. There's no logical reason for the sighting of the cockpit where it is, and in fact, the actual Air Force flying saucer, the Avrocar we referred to earlier, you know, apart from being much smaller, sighted its cockpits much closer to the wing. The few instances I know of, the only instance I know of where there is a patented design is the Silverbug project, which was another Avro project, and there the cockpit is sighted in the center of the disc. It is stepped a bit higher, so the cockpit view is a little bit better. But still, you know, these are, you know, I regard them as gorgeous fakes, but almost certainly fakes. There was an article, I believe, Popular Science or Popular Mechanics, so probably between 10 and 15 years ago, about a nuclear-powered flying saucer, which, again, they had some very attractive schematics, but there's no evidence that it was given serious consideration. There was also a project called Weapon System 606, which is supposedly an outgrowth or the precursor for the Silverbug project, but again, it didn't leave the drawing board, and it more closely resembles probably the fuselage of an F-106, which is a delta-winged interceptor, very similar to the French Mirage fighters, and an avenue which we didn't really pursue.
Well, I'm getting sucked into all the other sections.
There are wonderful... You were just looking at Lightcraft, which I believe
under experimental propulsion...
Conjectural laser-powered, ground-based laser-powered, vertical takeoff to VTOO craft, vertical takeoff to orbit. There's the parlance of modern astronautics is sometimes a little confusing. An acronym, well, a set of initials really that pops up early on in the 60s is SSTO, single stage to orbit, which would be essentially that. One very large booster, which would lift a large amount of materiel into Earth orbit and have enough fuel on board to land vertically. This was eventually superseded by the space shuttle space plane concept, which HT HL, horizontal takeoff, horizontal landing, TO, to orbit, something like that. Anyway, it's a mouthful of letters. But, yes, LaceyWorks is a marvelous site, full of wonderful images, some of which cannot be found.
He's got a bad link there.
Yep.
Well, IFOs are certainly important for UFO investigators.
My personal favorite is one which I don't know a whole lot about, and that's the Cousinet disc, French project.
Looks pretty cool. Looks like a real flying saucer.
And, you know, definitely something that metal was cut on. But I... And that looks like...
That's just a classic thin saucer with a nice little glass dome and
yes,
retractable gear.
Do you notice the difference between that and the previous photograph?
Yeah, it's got a shell and a pod on the bottom.
Look again and pay especially attention to the edge of the disc.
It's single as a...
Look at the previous... There.
Well, there they're intermeshed, kind of. Is that...
I believe the subsequent photograph shows the machine powered up.
What makes you... I mean, in the
Because I believe the serrations in the edge of the disc are a kind of fan impeller. I believe the whole shell of the
disc... Oh, so you think this is a blur of it spinning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. Because in the still... Well, in the first photograph, they both appear to be stills, but the one has a serrated edge. It looks like two... gears placed on top of each other with fingers slightly interlacing, but in the other image it appears like a smooth surface.
And I believe the
freaky
what you see in the photograph looks like blurring at the perimeter of the disc.
Yeah, okay. Man, he's awfully close. Actually he's in this photograph too. Wait a minute. That's probably a different one. But that's the René Cousinet's RC-360 from 1952. Aerodyne was unveiled in Paris by designer René Cousinet. Tree 135 horsepower engines. Three 135 horsepower engines would supply the power.
Which is rather modest.
So is that like a jet engine on the bottom there?
That I don't know. I haven't actually seen that schematic before. But
very
you can see in that in the plan view that you know it does appear to be it's exactly
a flying
like
buzzsaw.
You said. It looks like a pair of gears superimposed on one another. Both very shallow pan shapes. And that's clearly a model of
in wood.
An operational version.
In wood and with fins, though.
Mm-hmm.
How... If that thing is spinning... Well, strange. Very interesting.
I would guess that the area exterior to the... what looked like viewports... about a third of the way out from the small dome at the center are stationary, and then everything outboard of that spins.
And in the photograph it says the French Aerodyne has a diameter of almost 27 feet. It will be powered by, as I said, three 135 horsepower engines and the turbojet reactor visible on the underside and the lower view. Philadelphia Inquirer, July 5th, 1955.
The internal combustion engines would have been to power the lifting vanes of the disc, and the turbojet would have been for forward motion. Now, René Cousinet, and apologies to any of our listeners if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, was a minor but significant French aircraft designer. I know him from a beautiful, one of the most beautiful aircraft of the 30s, a tri-motor called the Arc-en-Ciel, means rainbow in English, and it was intended as a transatlantic mail plane. Unique in that it had a rather slab-sided configuration. It was smooth-skinned and low-winged in contrast to the better-known Ford tri-motor. The engines were in lines with forward radiators, fairly thick wing characteristic of the 30s, and a stepped kind of DC-3-style fuselage, DC-3-style cockpit. It was unique in that, you know, most aircraft fuselages will taper back, and the tail will, the rudder, the vertical fin, will stick out from the fuselage. The fuselage of the Arc-en-Ciel was designed such that the whole fuselage tapered back and swept up from the top to form the rudder.
Very stylish.
Yeah. Oh, it's a beautiful aircraft. It's I happened to get the old Heller, which is a French model company, kit of it a number of years ago, and still haven't built it because I'm kind of intimidated by it. But it's one of the my favorite pieces in my collection. But heavens to Betsy, what a road I've led us down.
You and your models and your aviation history. Nah. Well, I guess at some point we should announce that we've arranged something interesting for future episodes.
Yes, indeed. We're going to... Miles has been talking to the Nick Redfern of the Center for Fortean Zoology, and more recently of the very stimulating blog UFO Mystic, along with Greg Bishop and Craig Woolheater. And we've been talking about interviewing him on the show. I am looking forward guardedly to it. Miles and I have two somewhat different takes on one of Nick's more recent books, Body Snatchers in the Desert. But I'm definitely looking forward to hopefully pleasant exchanges, you know, possibly bumping heads, but definitely interesting conversation.
Bumping heads is fun. I like all the things you see afterwards.
Miles, there are cheaper ways to... Well, never mind.
and less bruising.
Yes.
Nick Redfern is likely going to be joining us for some special interviews, but also we're hoping to have him on a regular basis, like once a month, to give us an update on the previously mentioned International Cryptozoology /Fortean Organization, CFZ, who are doing some cool videos. You can find their videos at anomalytv.com, where I've been posting them, or at, what's his other new blog, There's Something in the Woods.
Yes, you mentioned it, and I have yet to actually look it up.
He had a link to it here, and I was looking for it, but there's some great other new blogs I wanted to be sure and mention. The good folks over at Anomalist, which is Anomalist, www.anomalist.com, as well as Anomalist Books, have a blog now, and that is at anomalistbooks.com/news.
Oh,
and,
cool.
So far, they're focusing on books. Of course, they publish books, so they're going to be talking about a lot of theirs, including Nick Redfern's On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, and some of their other books like Bloodsuckers in the White House. Oh, wait, that's not the title. That's the blog entry.
The President's Vampire.
Yeah. And they've been publishing a bunch of great new and old books that you should check out.
Don't Call Me Clive. What's that one?
This is for the book In Alien Heat, which is... it's about the Warminster UFO flap way back.
And yeah. Brad Steiger's Strange Guests.
Yeah, Brad Steiger is one of those. He's sure churned them out over the years. He's
got
quite a collection. But I, that aside, I will say some of my favorite books that I often don't mention enough are Brad Steiger books, including...
I cut my teeth on them.
I'm trying to think of some of the ones that were my favorite, but probably the one that sticks out most in my mind is A Roadmap of Time, which was also re-released several years later as Brad Steiger Predicts the Future, because in the Roadmap of Time, he talked about something that really intrigued me and still intrigues me, and it's actually part of the heart of my ideas about regular UFO phenomena on this planet, and that's the idea of cycles. And Roadmap of Time talked about the Maxwell-Wheeler climate-culture cycle. And there's these two guys, Maxwell and Wheeler, and no, they're not the famous physicists, they looked at historical climate data and found what they identified as four major modes of climate on the planet, and that was warm, wet, warm, dry, cold, wet, cold, dry. And with those four designations and detailed descriptions of what that means or what constitutes that categorizing, they showed that there was apparently a 500-year cycle and a 100-year cycle for these phases. And the phases of these climate cycles corresponded to rises and falls in different types of culture, whether it be political institutions, revolutions, wars, certain types of art being more prevalent or not, and religious thought, just whole milieus of human cultural excretion being regulated or at least moving into concert with these phases. And he made some predictions based on what their data was suggesting. And among the things he predicted basically was, in essence, the fall of Eastern Europe, or rather Russia and the Soviet Union, and the rise of democracy, whatever.
Wow.
And I wasn't really so much, again, interested in all that. But, I mean, I've always been fascinated by cycles. You know, maybe it's just from having grown up on reading about UFO waves and flaps. I really have always been fascinated by biorhythms and cycles. So,
I have a vague recollection of hearing about this, but it sounds like something that I want to refresh my memory on. It's intriguing stuff, especially in light of the current controversy over global warming, which, you know, I'm passionately looking forward to bringing about the collapse of the West.
I'm glad that you bring that up, because, you know, I know that years ago when I was reading this, it was either that book and or Guy Lyon Playfair's The Cycles of Heaven, which talk about an amazing, amazing book. The Cycles of Heaven, it has got more little tidbits of potentially humanity-changing data as far as, like, the effects of electromagnetics on consciousness and physiology, and how, you know, just basic data, like, you know, there's an increase of this percentage of people calling in sick on any given day if there's an approaching front to the population center. And that was where I first heard of the term meteoropath to describe somebody like myself who is sensitive to weather changes in whatever way. Mm-hmm. For me, certain types of weather changes can give me really, really bad headaches.
I have experienced that, although there have been similar weather changes that I thought were correlations that haven't brought those on.
And those things likely change with, I mean, the body changes that one goes through over time too. But what I was going to say is it's in one or both of those books that I first learned of, I believe it was the RAND Corporation's research that may have been commissioned by the CIA back in the 70s, which predicted that we would be moving into another mini ice age. So take that, climate change, global warming, whatchamadoodles.
It's all a liberal plot anyway.
It was CIA disinfo.
Well,
but
now,
which is?
Much as I was looking forward to, you know, glaciers ending the odious problem of Quebec separatism, forever by the simple expedient of scraping it off the Canadian plane, along with the rest of Canada. But then who would we have to blame?
Blame Canada!
Blame Canada! And they'll march.
Yeah. The glaciers march on, and the ice moves slowly south. Anyway, I'll have to look back through those, because I think that's where I know I can find the reference to that. And if I'm while I'm on the subject of Cycles of Heaven, I was lucky enough to meet Guy Lyon Playfair completely unexpectedly the one time I was in London in 1999 for Paul Devereaux's Consciousness Conference. It was between sessions, and I was down sipping coffee and trying to contain my excitement at being in London and being with all these amazing minds and people and souls. And I saw somebody talking to somebody, and I kind of moved over and started getting eavesdropping on the conversation and moving in. And then I noticed the guy's name tag was Guy Lyon Playfair. I just flipped out and, you know, of course, started, you know, saying how much of an honor it was to meet him, and, you know, asking him questions about researcher or that researcher. Actually, the person I asked him about was somebody I've been wanting to tell you about in terms of UFO research. Ah. That, again, goes into this constellation of UFO researchers that I really, really respect, that I think are all thinking alike, but they don't seem to necessarily cite each other's work or cooperate or get together, even though they seem to have more or less all the same idea. Maybe it's egos, I don't know. But there's this particular other British researcher named Albert Budden, whose first book was originally, I think in Britain, it was called Allergies and Aliens, The Electromagnetic Indictment. And when it was released the U.S., I think it was just released as Psychic UFOs, Electromagnetics, and something, mm-hmm. something. But I've got it in the archive as well, and it's a fascinating book, and I was just immediately like, wow, this has got it. I mean, it's one of the most citated books I've ever seen on UFOs, and that's all based on electromagnetics research. But his ideas are rather paranormal. And what they boil down to is that there is some kind of other mind at large at work in the UFO phenomenon, and maybe several different types of mind at large, not just some supposed collective human unconscious, but as I've supposed, maybe the planet's consciousness or different species' collective unconsciousness, whatever. But his ideas are very similar to John Keel's and to Dr. Greg Little's and to Paul Devereaux's and to Michael Persinger's, but it's like they all have a piece of the puzzle, but he seems to have put all the pieces together in a very complex pattern that may come the closest to what I think is going on.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll even outside of whether his theory holds water or not, the data that he points to in the, you know, electrophysiology journals is fascinating. It just is like, well, holy shit, man. Okay, screw UFOs. You're telling me, you know, the human electromagnetic signature can interact with the environment, and the environment can interact with it, and there's data to suggest all this, and that, you know, that this, yeah, that brings up all kinds of issues of parapsychological importance and just mainstream science.
It's documented that some animals, sharks for example, can sense electromagnetic fields at tremendous distances. You know, as far as I know, there's no identified mechanism in the human body that senses electromagnetic fields beyond the visible spectrum. But, you know, is that something that's, you know, it's like we were talking, you know, is that a sense that's atrophied or a sense that has yet to evolve? Now, if you look at the kind of conventional view of evolution, that it's linear, that species are essentially replaced by more efficient species, more complex species, you know, yeah, maybe. I don't know. But this sounds like fascinating stuff. Kind of off mic, I mentioned before the broadcast that I was mistaken. I do not have a copy of Flying Saucers Are Real, the first Donald Kehoe book, I believe.
Maybe. It's one of, like, three I think he wrote.
But I did discover, to my surprise, that I have Jacques Vallée's Confrontations, which you cited to me on this program.
Yeah, Jacques Vallée's Confrontations is the second in his Alien Contact trilogy. That was really his last... well, he did do one other UFO book after that. I think it was his Russian Samizdat UFO book, UFOs in the Soviet Union. In his journals, excuse me, his Forbidden Science, his collected journals from, like, his childhood in France to, I believe, the mid to late 70s. And one of the amazing things I learned from that book was that he had had a UFO, a classic flying disc sighting. I mean, the disc we saw, the French saucer, mm-hmm. that's the classic kind of disc that he says he saw as a kid. I think through binoculars, and I think it was it may have been a multi-witness sighting with family members, but that was one of the things that apparently charged his interest in this. At least I feel like I read that there. And the thing is, most people, though, and usually when I think of him having his first introduction to UFOs was, I thought, before then, his often cited experience where a astronomer whom he respected, he witnessed destroying evidence, physical record, like electromagnetic tape recordings of unidentifieds that were seen recorded on this guy's telescope.
Whoa.
And he was like, wait, you're a scientist. This is what you're about, is the unknown. It's finding mm-hmm. explanations yes. for the natural world or the unnatural world. And
that was
I don't think he actually confronted him with that. It was just witnessing that implies that, you know, that science doesn't want to confront these things, or
some scientists.
But anyway, Confrontations is a really good one. That's the one that we were mentioning, I think, in the other show about the South American, the violent, aggressive.
Little hairy dwarves.
Well, no, oh yeah, yeah, them as well. But I was also thinking of the Chupa Chupas, the Chupacabras, the flying refrigerators that were zapping natives and causing radiation burn effects and killing some people and causing their flesh to fall off their bones and all manner of wonderful, pleasant things. And in mass, in some cases, terrorizing a small village. And then the military getting involved, and seemingly we find out decades later that they. Were told to, you know, ridicule instead of help the natives, even though they were there publicly saying, oh, we're the military, we're here to help, and we're documenting all this, and we're going to give you a report, and then it was basically all covered up. Confrontations, also, I think I don't recall the details of all the things he covers in there, but Vallée covers usually in all his books the psychic impact on the percipients and their usual typical change in belief systems and whatnot, others.
Go to the analyst. We're just about at the end of the hour, and something that we both felt we should mention, there's a very nice obituary of a woman, very important researcher in parapsychology who passed away this week.
Actually, well, this was... He wrote it this week.
Ah.
She actually passed away several months ago. At least...
February
24th.
A couple of...
I think I mentioned
about 2 months.
I mentioned this hurriedly in the midst of my interview with Robert Larson on the Blue Rose Report months ago, and Ray White, Recollections of a Life in Parapsychology and Beyond, posted April 24th, 2007, written by Carlos Alvarado, PhD, Parapsychology Foundation. I was so glad that you mentioned this because. Ray White is somebody that really inspired me. She was involved heavily in parapsychology, but she came to be very tired with it and moved into her own expression of the scientific and personal experience and exploration of strange phenomena. And She founded her own organization called the Exceptional Human Experience Network, and her PSI-Line database, PSI-Line database, which was one of the most up-to-date bibliographic news citation science reports sourcing databases around. But it was also a collection of people's personal experiences of what she had coined as EHEs, Exceptional Human Experiences. And these, she was getting at the heart of the experience. And this is actually connects really with what you were, what I was going to say about Valet, is the impact on the impact on the witness, the percipient, the abductee, the UFO encontrant, whatever you want to call them, the person who witnesses or experiences these strange phenomena, often have a radical change of worldview and paradigm shifting type of change in their psyche, and sometimes developing seemingly psychic abilities. And so she focused on those changes and the internal appreciation of people's experiencing of the strange and mysterious. And for that, I thought she was rather visionary, because, of course, she had a scientific background, and she certainly appreciated all of that. But she didn't see that science was doing really anything worth a rat's ass. I mean, it was needed, and I'm sure she was glad that it had been done. But anyway, I had corresponded with her over the years and started writing my own Exceptional Human Experience journal, collecting and writing about the different strange experiences in my life, ranging from precognitive dreams to synchronicities, being shot as a child and what that meant to me mentally, and all kinds of things. The Battle of the Flowers Parade in San Antonio when I was in third or fourth grade, I wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't for Mother's intuition. We went down to the Battle of the Flowers Parade in San Antonio and set up across the street, or rather we set up in front of this parked mobile home, but my mom was convinced that we'd get sunburned sitting right there, so we moved to the opposite side of the street. Well, lo and behold, after the shooting stopped and we safely exited the vicinity, it turned out in that trailer. And I believe everybody where we were sitting that was right there in front of him was killed. Yeah. So thank you for Mother's intuition. Thank you, Mom.
This was some deranged individual who just opened up on the crowd?
I've been meaning to go to archives and dig up as much about this as I can, because I can't find anything about it online, but it happened. I mean,
yeah,
you know. And from what I understand, he had holed up in this this area, this trailer, had supposedly like three shopping carts full of weapons and ammunition.
Good Lord.
And he opened fire on the crowd, and there was a standoff for hours and hours and hours. And I have a memory of, as we were running away, tear gas flying down from above the buildings, but I'm not sure if that's real or not. But I'll always remember, never forget, when we were running away, a woman in a car stopped us and asked what was going on, and we said, "There's some psycho shooting everybody." And she said, "Well, after they kill him, are they still going to have the parade?" And we just turned and ran.
So, I can't think of a finer note to end this week's Precognitive Dissonance on.
Well, with that said, I guess we'll just say good night for Precognitive Dissonance.
Keep dodging those bullets. And we'll see you all next week. I'll be back in just a few minutes for another installment of the Anomaly Radio Audiobook Hour.
Cool, man. All right. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Precognitive Dissonance on the Anomaly Radio Network. That's anomalyradio.com, precognitivedissonance.com, precognitivedissonance.podomatic.com, and...
Problematic?
Dogmatic. I mean, wait. Not Dogmatic, but Podomatic, where you can get the podcast.
Oh, Podomatic.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
New government report. Pot is more potent than ever.